prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Unsung Horrors. I'm Erica.
I'm Lance.
In this episode, we're going to be discussing a new book, Warped and Faded, Weird Wednesday in the Birth of the American Genre Film Archive. Joining us for this discussion is the author of the book, as well as the lead programmer for Austin Film Society, Lars Nilsson. Welcome, Lars.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you here. We both have the book. We love it. Not just as fans of both AGFA and Weird Wednesday and Austin Film Society, but you know, there's so much in this that is for just film fans in general. So, but before we do jump into the book, before I gush too much, I did want to talk briefly about AFS, especially for our Austin listeners. So if you haven't already, you can actually become a member and get benefits at AFS, such as discounted tickets and free screenings at AFS, or you can even just make a donation to support their programming as well as local filmmakers on their website. And I'll put a link to the website and where to donate in show notes for this. And just as an example of what you can see at AFS, this month there is an essential cinema series of Lynn Ramsey films, as well as select films by Bill Morrison, who's scheduled to be in attendance, such as Dawson City Frozen Time, Dacacia, and The Village Detective. And this series is in conjunction with an exhibition at the University of Texas Visual Arts Center called Bill Morrison Cycles and Loops, which is going to be running from January 28th through March 12th. So encourage our Austin listeners to definitely check all of that stuff out.
And I would just throw in, because I'm not so sure I knew this when I first came to Austin, you can either be a member at AFS or you can just kind of walk up and buy a ticket. So, yeah. I mean, it makes sense to become a member if you're going to the movies more than like two times a month. But yeah, so people can just kind of sample the experience too. It's, I think it's a great community. It's a big thing that I've, you know, wanted to do when I got to AFS 8 years ago or whatever, is kind of build that community of like-minded people. So I think for a lot of people, they move to Austin and they may not quite get how to just sort of jump in and, you know, how to do Austin as a verb. Mm-hmm. But a good way to do that is to just kind of like join the film society and then like have conversations and make friends and come to those events. So we're trying to make that a big part of what we do, is like just make it a community.
And you're absolutely right, because, you know, I've been here about 10 years and I just became a member, I think, for the first time 3 years ago, because that was me just like going selectively and buying a ticket. So multiple ways that you can go to AFS and support them always are encouraged. So one thing I did want to bring up is like a couple of things that did happen at AFS. So Lars, in particular, the screening of Come and See a couple of years ago, you introduced it as the best film that you'll only see once, or that you'll only want to see once.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how appropriate that description of that film is.
It's a tough movie. And I really appreciate the fact that people do want to feel that level of experience, because certainly it is possible to have a movie going life in which you're really just entertaining yourself, to have a movie going life in which you really are. The quote that is often used, in which I deplore, is to turn your brain off, you know,
right.
Which I think the corollary is to that is turn your heart off too. So I think that it's important that people are able to experience the greatest art form that's ever been invented, the art form that can encompass many of the other art forms into itself, and experience that at its greatest power, even when it's bumming you out, even when it's creating a panic attack, yeah. You know, I think it's important to let this art form work and do its best work on us, to do things other than just divert us or make us forget our troubles at work, for instance.
And speaking of, you know, emotions, So another aspect of Austin Film Society is the viewfinders. So there's a Facebook page for Austin Film Society viewfinders, as well as a podcast that you do as well, Lars. And the Vulcan Video exit interviews gave me all the feelings. I teared up watching those.
Yeah.
That was tough, but it was also really nice that you put all that together. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't have a lot of time for doing podcasts and doing viewfinder stuff, just because my job is so time consuming. Sure. Frankly, you'd be surprised how time consuming it is to program two little screens, you know.
Yeah.
But the way we program the two screens at AFS is really like, it's like we have nine screens. You know, we don't just like throw something out there and let it play. We have an average of, you know, 30 screenings per week. And there are 9 or 10 discrete titles each week generally. So it is pretty time consuming. But during the pandemic, AFS, for whatever their reasons, decided to keep me on staff and to continue paying me, which was nice. But I did feel like I needed to work for my money. So yeah, I did a whole lot of podcasts and even video series and stuff like that, just so that I could feel justified in drawing a paycheck from AFS during that time.
Yeah. Well, the good thing about it is, like, you know, people can go back and always listen to or watch those, even if that's not something that's happening right now. So definitely recommend folks checking that out as well.
The Vulcan exit interviews, I'm so proud of having done that. And I'm really glad that you got the desired result of that. I mean, I think that it kind of builds to the sort of climax where Kristen Ellisor talks and you see how much it meant to her, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you hear from everybody how much it meant to them. And one refrain that goes throughout is like, well, Kristen was really the rock. She really held this place together. And then finally you get to hear from Kristen. And I don't know, I thought it was very moving to have those sort of discussions about something that seems trivial to some people, like a video store, you know, and to hear how meaningful it was to all these people.
Yeah, I mean, because Eric and I were going to the Taps and Tapes right before everything was closing down. And
yeah.
When I watched those, I was touched, because I just live right up the road from where the newest location was for Vulcan.
Yeah,
and that was, that was a dagger in the heart.
That one stings. But we still have a good film culture here in Austin, and we get a lot of a history of what that looked like from the book. So the first part of the book is like a weird Wednesday oral history, and it's got snippets from Tim and Carrie League, Harry from Exhumed Films, Lisa Petrucci from Something Weird Video, Zach Carlson and Josie Emba, Kayla Janice, Rob Jones, who's co-founder of Mondo, tons of other filmmakers, and even Weird Wednesday attendees. So, Lance, I know one name came up in that section, one of your favorite directors.
Jamal Fanaka?
Yeah.
Yeah. And reading this too, you know, Lars, I know you're a big fan, obviously, of him too, which was, I loved seeing that profile, him making it into that Weird Wednesday Hall of Fame section, which is another cool part of this book. I mean, that Hall of Fame section includes people like Al Adamson, Gary Kent, George Buck Flower, Mimsy Farmer, Susan Terrell, all justifiably, you know, Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
But Jamal Fanaka, that is... in past episodes, I mean, I pretty much recommend one of his movies in at least every other episode.
Pretty much, yeah.
So I guess Eric is getting annoyed with it.
It's either that or you make a Twin Peaks reference. So, which, yeah, you know, it's fine. True. I love you for it.
So, yeah, it sounds like you got pretty, I'm not going to say close, but you did establish a relationship with him. And there's a story in there where I think it was Penitentiary that you programmed. And then he reached out and was, you know, asking, oh, you showed my film, and you, just on a whim, not sure if you even had the budget or had the power to do that, but offered and invited him to come out to the Draft House for programming.
It was actually Emma May that he...
Emma May. Okay.
He had read on IMDb, somebody had written an IMDb review of Emma May saying that, oh, I saw this at my local theater, the Alamo Draft House, and I guess Jamal, you know, he was still going back and reading the reviews, because a lot of times filmmakers don't get a lot of feedback on their films, you know. But he was going back and reading the reviews and said, wait a minute, they showed my film? And then he called and he caught the day manager, Thomas Hanawa. And Thomas Hanawa, like, let me know. He's like, hey, this guy called, and I guess we showed one of his films. And for me, the instant reaction was kind of like, oh no, we got to pay somebody. Because that happened a few times. I'm not going to say that the finances were always in line with modern business practices for the Weird Wednesday series. But anyway, yeah, we had shown the film and he called and I called him back just fully expecting to just be like, yeah, you know, I'm sorry, we didn't in the Library of Congress listing, it didn't list you as the current rights holder. If you'll send me an invoice, I can, you know, I'll send you $200 or something. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what he wanted to talk about at all. He wanted to just say, how did you like the movie? How did people like it? You know, he was just excited like a kid. And yeah, that was how the sort of idea came up to have him come out, show Penitentiary. I don't remember what we showed. I think we showed Welcome Home, Brother Charles, mm-hmm. and maybe Pen 3. Maybe it was Penitentiary 3 we showed that first time he came out. No, it was Penitentiary. That's right, because it was at the original Draft House, and he did a whole Q&A that was just – it was so inspirational to hear him talk about – you know, his whole story and how he came up, which is a really special thing. I wish he'd written a book, mm-hmm. But it was so special at how he come up because he was almost 30 years old, literally about to go commit a robbery, he says. And then he saw a billboard saying UCLA Film School wants you that was posted in Compton. And I guess he went over to UCLA Film School and said, hey, I'm here. And he became a student and he was, you know, he remained a student there for 10 years or something, making 3 films that were nationally released during that time, including one that was a major commercial hit, which was Penitentiary, made while he was still at UCLA Film School. Yeah, he told the whole story of that. And then he told the story of filming Penitentiary and the lessons that he kind of learned by making a somewhat bigger movie and having to go out on location and having to keep his cast and crew kind of housed in the jailhouse while they were using that set. And it was pretty amazing experience. He was a very funny guy. He was just a prince of a guy. And I love Jama. He told me that we were friends for life and I took him at his word. And I think as long as I live, we'll be friends because Jama's not with us anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that kind of stood out to me is, and it comes up a lot, especially in the first section, is that it's very sort of playing it free and loose. But the ability to do that has to do with, you know, the audience that you had and their expectations going into that. And so I guess my question is, and this is something that Bill Ackerman on Supporting Characters podcast always asks his guests about, if there's aspect in present day film culture that's particularly frustrating to you. So do you find that the attitude change or those, is that frustrating to you as a film programmer?
I don't know. Not really, I guess. I mean, I just don't think these movies are kind of for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a sort of sense of humor. Like sometimes you can even watch a movie that is coming from such a wrong place and it can be just hilarious. Like there's a movie called Office Girls that we showed that is just so, I mean, it's really a sort of pro-sexual harassment movie. But to watch that and to laugh at it is not to endorse sexual harassment. It's to just kind of laugh at just how absurd and wrong it is, you know. But I think that something has happened. Maybe if there's a thing that sort of frustrates me, it's the notion that when we enjoy something, we're sort of endorsing it, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. That we can't just sort of enjoy something as an artifact of history. I'm just generally interested in history and I always have been.
Yeah.
So looking at historical attitudes and sort of tracking historical attitudes can be fun and funny without feeling like what a wonderful sense of nostalgia I feel from this. You know, it's not a wonderful sense of nostalgia so much. It can just be like a sense of the absurdity of the human race and the absurdity of human progress, you know? And I think that I do feel that sometimes. I think that there's a bit of an impoverished, among a lot of people, and it's not just younger people, but among a lot of people, there's an impoverished sense of the tools that people bring to comprehending films or other works of art or artisanship are inadequate, I think, sometimes for a reading of it. So people are reading films, I think, more and more on a more shallow level. And I think that happens all the time. There's this new movie. What is this new Adam McKay movie that everybody's like on Twitter? Don't Look Up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I saw somebody had just posted like, "Hey, you know, Don't Look Up. It's about a comet hitting Earth. It could imagine if they made a movie about global warming." And I feel like, isn't that what the Don't Look Up is kind of about? It's like an obviously parsable symbolic representation of that. Because I think that that's a thing where people aren't necessarily reading films on multiple levels. And I think that sort of pisses me off a little bit. I do remember I saw an article maybe 5 years ago, and it was one of these places like Vulture or someplace like that, where somebody said, "Hey, guess what, you guys? RoboCop, the original Paul Verhoeven RoboCop, is actually a really interesting social satire. It's not just a dumb action movie."
Yeah.
Like, everybody got that in 1984. It's like, you didn't just have like this great breakthrough. It's like, you're just unused to dealing with multiple levels in your art, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing, I guess, that sort of pisses me off a little bit. I don't feel like we have that problem at AFS, because I think the audiences that are accustomed to sort of reading things on multiple levels and tracking multiple levels are with us. But I do think that it's a general sort of socially problematic social trend. Is that people are becoming accustomed to sort of tracking things on a much more shallow level.
Well said. Thank you for that. Lance, do you have anything from the first section?
No, I mean, I just wanted to give kudos to Kirla for the editing job on this book, because of the, you know, the amount of interviews and the timelines involved. You know, I don't know how in-depth she was in, as far as editing and putting this thing together, but...
Oh, my God. Yeah, she did the book.
Yeah, okay.
My name's on the book. I wrote all this stuff, you know. I wrote this stuff years ago. I mean, some of it I had to, like, go back and then I had to, you know, go in and do frame grabs at AGFA and stuff like that, so that when you see, like, the big frame blow-ups and stuff like that.
Okay.
I sat down with Sebastian and Kayla, and we did that at AGFA. But yeah, for the most part, this is kind of Kayla's book. I'm operating on stolen valor here.
Yeah, I mean, that was a question too I had. All these write-ups for these hundreds of films, were these pulled from the programming guides, or did you have to rewrite some specifically for the book?
Oh my God, it was so difficult. Because like it's like I've had, how many computers have I had since 2001,
yeah.
You know? And it's like, oh, I'm sure I've really kept all these backups of these. I haven't. So for a lot of them, I was just like, okay, I've got this, this, and this. I found this in an old email account from emailing it to Tim. But yeah, going back to program guides that had been scanned to PDFs, and there's text recognition that you can pull off those PDFs, but
oh, wow.
It doesn't work very well. You know, it like recognizes a comma as a J and, you know, all this crazy stuff.
Yikes.
So editing this, it ended up taking an incredible amount of time. It took like all my nights and weekends for like a month and a half, probably just preparing the manuscript. So, I mean, it's nothing compared to what Kayla did, because she really did the work on this thing. But yeah, it was a bitch getting all this stuff together. And it has actually made me, like, I bought a backup drive and stuff, and I was just like, never again.
Right.
I'm going to back up my Gmail account and all my Google Docs and everything that I use, because it was such a pain having to go back and prepare this. And there were definitely things that write-ups had never been prepared for, because they were in the early days of it. And in that case, Kayla gave me the option. It was like, do you want to write these, you know, 75 new write-ups, or do you want me to hire somebody to do that? And I was like, go hire somebody, please. God. So she hired, you know, Jasmine Moreno, who programs mm-hmm. at AFS with me now, and some other people to kind of come in and do some write-ups for the things that had never had write-ups in the first place, because they were last minute substitutions, or they were from the early days before there was ever a program guide.
Right. Eric has already praised the book, but yeah, just having it all in one collection along with, you know, the history of, you know, AGFA and then the Weird Wednesday programming and, you know, a brief history of the Draft House itself. It's just, it's a great book, and the way it's put together is just fantastic.
Yeah. I think the thing that it helps people maybe kind of understand is just what a total renegade operation
right.
that it was at the beginning. I mean, it was in a parking garage. Tim and Carrie were in their 20s. We were breaking the law every day. I mean, there were so many laws broken. It was so unsafe. I mean, there was asbestos in the pizza dough. It was just really...
Is that a true story?
No.
I was like, oh, well, we're going to get some scoop.
I'm making that part up. Okay. But it was just, I remember that there were like ceiling tiles up above the theater where people sat.
Yeah.
And sometimes the day managers would come in and one of those glass like ceiling tiles would have fallen down and shattered and they'd have to like clean it up. And I'm thinking like, was that not like a red flag? Those glass freaking ceiling tile things or whatever the hell they were needed to come down. I mean, thankfully it just never fell on anybody when they're in the cinema, but like it absolutely could have.
Yeah.
It was such an irresponsible operation. But I learned a lot from that because it did show that like you could use the forward momentum of just having passion and having ideas and just kind of say fuck it to everything else and you could make it work, you know? Yeah. People spend so much time kind of thinking, oh, what would happen if this, what would happen if we did this? What would happen if we did that? And what I learned from Tim really, and to some extent Carrie, although she was just kind of indulging Tim sometimes, was that you could just sort of do it, you know? You just go out there and just do the thing that you feel like doing without kind of worrying so much of like, is this wrong? Is this illegal? If you're pure of heart, it tends to sort of work out. If you're doing the right thing, the universe and the muses like have a weird way of just kind of helping you.
Yeah. Let's jump into some of our picks. So the middle section of the book is the bulk of it. It's a compendium of these Weird Wednesday screenings. And Lance and I each have five picks from those movies. And this is mainly to give listeners a sense of, these are the types of movies that you'll find in this book. And I treated my list as this isn't top five favorites or anything like that. This is a five movies of fuck, I wish I had been there for that. Right.
Yeah. Or I've seen the movie and I really wish I was in watching this with an audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's.
I did go with some of my favorites. Though.
Okay. That's right.
I realized what I was doing. So my last couple of picks.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to kick us off? What's your first one, Lance?
Sure. I mean, we've already talked about Jamal Fanaka. So my first pick is MMA from 1976, also known as Black Sisters Revenge.
I don't understand. They always talking about how we young people never try to do nothing but use dope and kill each other up in the street. Then when we try to do something the way they say it's supposed to be done, they mess with us and try to shut us down. There'll come a time in your life when you're gonna have to make a decision. But people don't understand.
Like I said, right off the bat, I'm kind of going with my favorite from this book. I mean, it's hard to pick a favorite. You know, before we started recording, we said there's so many great films in this. It's, Bird with a Crystal Plumage. I mean, there's so many just classics that you can select. But, I mean, it focuses heavily on character development, just family relationships, family dynamic of kind of taking in this different personality or different, you know, how to accept different viewpoints. Some of our listeners might have already heard me talk about this film a bit, but it's a young woman named Emma May who moves in with her family in South Central LA after her mother dies. And Emma May she's straight off the farm. She's coming from a small town in Mississippi. So we watch how she copes with the culture shock of this big city living and her family, who are all strong-minded, just like herself. And she just kind of steps into this leadership role of sorts and establishes just how tough she is with this take no shit attitude. And people start really, you know, kind of following her in more ways than one. So, I mean, I definitely have recommended this a few times on the podcast, just like with all of Jamal's films. And I'm going to continue to recommend these, but when I saw it was in the book, I just knew it had to be on the list. So everybody must see this movie. Lars has already talked about how he's a huge fan. I mean, all his movies, Welcome Home, Brother Charles, all three Penitentiaries. It's MMA is on a double feature disc with Vinegar Syndrome release with Welcome Home, Brother Charles, which is an immediate pickup, in my opinion.
If MMA came from Rio, if it was about Sao Paulo or something, you know, and it was subtitled, it was in Portuguese and subtitled, then it would be an art film. You know what I mean?
It's more than a blaxploitation film, 100%.
Yeah, I mean, it does end up kind of going in a sort of genre sort of direction when it becomes about
gangs and stuff. And
yeah, yeah, it, there's a heist and, or there's a crime and a hideout and stuff like that. But, but yeah, for the most part, it is, it's really kind of more of like kind of a family drama. And I think from Jamah, it was a lot kind of his story coming from the South, going to South Central. He and his family had immigrated from the South to South Central LA. And it wasn't just Jamah's story. It was the story of a lot of people who came to South Central LA. Because that sort of pipeline from the deep South to working in the aircraft industry or other job opportunities in LA was not an uncommon one.
All right. So my first pick is by one of my favorite Italian directors, Andrea Bianchi, and it's Cry of a Prostitute from 1974.
For a lousy $25, some men think they can do anything just to hear the cry of a prostitute. Passion explodes like never before. Cry of a prostitute. You'll hear it echo in your blood.
Starring Henry Silva and Barbara Boucher. And on the surface, it's a poliziotteci, but it definitely feels more like a Yojimbo-inspired spaghetti western with Henry Silva in the middle of a feud between two mafia families. Silva's got this whistle in it every time he's about to kill someone or sneak up on someone, which I love. And Barbara Boucher, the reason it's called Cry of a Prostitute is essentially because, so Barbara Boucher is a former prostitute and she is now married to one of the head of the mafia. She gets a shit beat out of her essentially. And by pretty much everyone, including a particularly nasty scene with Henry Silva and a huge chunk of, a huge meat carcass. We'll say that. So I guess, Lars, my question for this one is, What was the crowd like for this one, or if you remember the reception for that, and particularly that scene? Because I feel like even for me, it didn't make me uncomfortable, but I can see it might make some people uncomfortable.
You know, it happened with the Italian. It probably happened around this screening, which was I guess this was maybe 10 or 11 years ago, that I sort of realized that my love of the poliziotteschi is not necessarily shared by everyone. Mm-hmm. Even high crime, like Castellari's High Crime, which is about as good as it gets. It's like, I screened that probably three times and it just never worked. And Cry of a Prostitute definitely didn't work with the audience. I mean, people were just kind of a little bit stunned by the brutality of it and sort of the ugliness of it, that it never really had a chance to sort of fly. Mm-hmm. Because there are, I mean, Andrea Bianchi is an absolute sleazy director. I mean, all of his films are pretty sleazy, frankly. And so he really kind of exists in that world. He's going for it. He's not avoiding it. It's not like he uses sleaze as a bridge to get to someplace. He's just going to sleaze country. That's the only place where he's going. It's not just a means to an end. It's the end. and so I think with Cry of a Prostitute, it really didn't work. I played it one time and never played it again because it was such a bad vibe situation. I'm impressed that it pulled that one out. And that's the first one you wanted to talk about. I haven't watched it again. It gave me such, indigestion, frankly, to watch it with an audience. When you program a film and it's not working, mm-hmm. And then you're sitting with an audience and watching it for, in real time for 90 minutes, it is such an uncomfortable experience because you can tell it's not working. You can just feel the energy in the room. And then when it's over, you're going to make eye contact with people again. Yeah. And people are going to have their sort of parting remarks as they leave for the night, It's not a good feeling. And that would definitely, Cry of a Prostitute was not a good time, fun movie, I have to say.
Yeah, I would never. Yeah, I can see that. And I do recommend it. I think at this point, our listeners understand my tastes and why I like people like Bianchi. I like the sleaze. I like mean movies. I like stuff like that. So this is for those people who share those tastes with me, it's not for most people.
Yeah. Okay, I'm assuming you've seen The Boss, the DeLeo movie. Correct?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
So Henry Silva.
And another Caliber 9 and yeah.
Caliber, yeah. That's where, you know, that's where my heart is, you know. It's like, the meaner the better. It's like, did you run over a child in that movie? Yes, thank you. Did you like have a downbeat ending? All these, you know, I love all the good stuff. And like the more sleaze the better, so.
Movies are terrific. I saw a Henry Silva movie recently. It was a French movie. I had never seen it before. And it's almost like it was a takeoff of those kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. I'll have to look and see what the hell the damn thing was called, because I can't think of what it was called. But it was definitely a French movie. Skip it. I'll think of it later.
Okay. I did get around to the last Henry Silva movie I watched was just a few days ago, Manhunt in the City. And it's an Umberto Lenzi movie, and it was a little frustrating for me because Henry Silva, you know, he's got like the tough guy picture on the key art, but he's kind of a wimp in this. It's like you're sitting there and you're like, that's not Henry Silva. That's not what I want. This isn't, go like beat some fucking people up. Your daughter's dead. Come on. And he never really does it. And it was a little underwhelming for me, unfortunately.
Yeah. You hate to see it.
Yeah. All right, Lance, your next pick.
Okay, so I'm going to go with a Weird Wednesday Hall of Famer. Arthur Marx. This is Friday Foster from 1975. What you doing, girl?
Hey, what you doing? It's open season on that super sister. And every stud in his brother is out to put her down. Or shake her up. But she don't dig their game.
I'm delivering the milk.
Fancy, there is nothing you have that I want. And I don't hustle for nobody.
So I recently watched a bunch of Arthur Marx movies. JD's Revenge, Bucktown, which I had never seen before. And I really enjoyed that with Fred Williamson. But I feel like they're all a blast to watch. But I had so much fun with Friday Foster. Due in part to the cast, namely Pam Grier as Friday Foster. She plays an assistant photographer who's quickly plunged into this web of conspiracy involving assassination attempts on the richest black man in America and murders involved. Blake Tarr. That's his name. her closest friends, U.S. senators are being murdered. There's a plot to eliminate the country's African-American political leadership. And then by her side, the entire time working to unravel these mysteries and murders is private detective Colt Hawkins, played brilliantly by Yaphet Kotto. The dynamic between these two characters, Friday and Colt, is captivating. They're just hilarious. They bicker, they flirt, they joke with each other. They kind of have this weird boyfriend, this partner, I guess they're together in the movie on and off, but you know, she's sleeping with other people as well. But as they like gather clues, closing on solving the case, it just made me want five more of these movies. Like I can imagine just a series of these two together. It's super great. I mean, the whole cast is great. There's a young Carl Weathers in it. Scatman Crothers is in it. Eartha Kitt, just solid all around, fun, action packed. This is my second pick. I can't recommend it enough.
It's so good. We just showed it again, actually, at AFS. And it was the same print, the same studio print that I got back in the day. And it's such a dark print, which is so annoying. I don't know if you guys went to that, but it's a really dark print. It's like a badly graded print. And nobody will ever make another print of that, unfortunately. So that's just kind of what you're stuck with. But yeah, like watching Friday Foster, it's like it's Pam Grier at the point when she really had some control over her career. Like her movies had been making a ton of money. And so she was, you know, it's actually the last movie that she made for AIP. It's the last lead that she played until Jackie Brown.
Oh, wow.
Unless you count like Grease Lightning and stuff, which are really not leads, but it was the last lead that she had played before then. And she's just kind of done with AIP. None of the big studios were going to make movies with her, but you really see in that, Pam Grier auteur sort of working with Arthur Marx on it because she had so much call with what she wanted to do. And like, for instance, Pam Grier, when you see her in Coffee and Foxy Brown, like she's Pam Grier. She looks wonderful, but she's not lit well. There wasn't real makeup time. She clearly did her own makeup and stuff like that. The clothes are not like, you know, she wears the same three outfits. Right. And Freddie Foster, she gets treated like a movie star. She gets made up like a movie star. She gets shot like a movie star, lit like a movie star. She's wearing all these gorgeous outfits. She's never looked better. I mean, how gorgeous is Pam Grier in Freddie Foster?
Yes.
And then she's got all these wonderful black stars with her. I mean, it's really like an alternate universe world where everybody's black practically, except for her sort of bumbling kind of photography, like boss type guy.
Yeah.
Whatever his name was. I can't remember what his name was. But yeah, it's really is an alternate universe kind of film. And it was based on a comic, like a daily newspaper comic strip. That weird thing that existed, the three panel, you know, continuity comic that people used to read. Maybe they still do. I don't know. But like, I don't understand the mindset that people were in where they would read three panels of a story every day. Like, how could you possibly track that story? Anyway, I don't know what I'm, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it didn't really, that comic strip, Freddie Foster, never really got picked up by enough newspapers. I think it ran in like literally 20 newspapers. So the property was not hot, but I'm just so glad that the movie got made out of that property.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Fun time. It's on Tubi too. It's streaming too, if anybody wants to watch it.
Okay.
Great music. Like it's got that, as I mentioned in my write-up, it's music by Luchi de Jesus. And he has one of those like voice bot, those vocoder things that like Peter Frampton uses.
Yes.
And he uses it throughout the movie.
It's about halfway when I recognized it and I was like, okay, this is a lot of Vox Vox. And then it, from then on, it's nonstop. It's so much. It's endearing, yeah, though. It's fun to listen to.
It's so good. How good is, how freaking, I mean, everybody's great in the cast. Of course, Yaphet Kotto, incredible. But how good is Eartha Kitt just in her one little scene? She's amazing.
Yeah, she's fantastic in it. I mean, I think she even had a singing number that she sings a bit for, if I remember, but maybe not. But now she, I mean, she's, everybody's fantastic. And then there's Ted Lange as the pimp.
Yeah, he's really funny. Yeah, and that was one of the sort of specifications that that Marx had to deal with coming from AIP, was that you needed to have, Pam Grier was going to have to do a nude scene, which he takes a shower and it's awkward, frankly. And then you had to have a pimp. So you see the way that they sort of like subverted the need to have a pimp in it by making him kind of this sort of, I mean, he's not bumbling exactly. He's just like, it's hopeless, you know, he's doing like a hopeless notion of trying to get Pam Grier in his stable. And her brother is leveraging the interest in his sister to his advantage, let's say.
All right, Erica, next pick for you.
Yeah. So my last one, so Cry of a Prostitute has a Code Red Blu-ray, which Code Red Blu-rays are not great, but it just...
I could tell stories.
But I we've heard them from Laird. this next one is actually part of a beautiful Blu-ray box set from Arrow, so people can pick it up. I think it's out of print, but I think you can probably find it somewhere. I'm not sure. Immoral Tales, directed by Valerian Borovchek. This is four erotic stories set during different time periods. The expanded version of this has a segment from Borovchek's The Beast, which if you've seen The Beast, I'll just call it a gooey segment. I definitely enjoyed the debauchery of this. I'm going to pull from your quick write-up on this, Lars. An anthology of four tales designed to shock, offend, and arouse. Incest, one of my favorite things in films. Lars didn't write that. That's my comment, folks. Well, listeners know that. All right. Incest, erotic bloodshed, unsanctioned use of fruits and vegetables, and a serious papal misconduct are all served up on a beautifully embossed silver platter. So... Nice. I think I should just preface this by saying that all of my picks are not for everyone. This is art house eroticism, and the four segments, there is the first one is The Tide. It's about a young man and his female cousin stranded on a secluded beach where he's sort of giving her lessons in sex and intimacy. If you can call it intimacy, it's not quite that. There is the second one is about a girl who is locked in her bedroom where she, let's say, uses what she can find around her to pass the time by. And then there's an Elizabeth Bathory segment. And then the last one is a Borgia segment concerning this incestuous orgy with Lucrezia, her brother, and her father, the Pope. So I love his stuff. Like, one of my favorite movies that I watched in the last few years was The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne. The Beast, I actually just watched for the first time this afternoon. And so, all I can see is horse cocks right now. So, like, I didn't see anything. Like, Lance, like, that's what your face looks like right now. So, sorry.
Thank you.
But, I'm curious about this one, too, at Weird Wednesday, Lars.
Yeah. It didn't work super great, I have to say. Mm. I mean, it is it's an art film. You know, it doesn't get right to it. It takes its time in sort of creating an atmosphere. And it's based on sort of erotic fiction. And kind of sort of like the hidden library, the sort of suppressed library of erotic fiction. It didn't quite work. It has worked much better at AFS when I've played that, because the crowd sort of shows up expecting an art movie to begin with. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a great sort of Weird Wednesday, I have to say, as much as I like the film. Seeing it on 35mm is special and wonderful. And so I didn't sit there and just sort of like hit myself like I did for like Cry of a Prostitute. Like, oh, why did I feel like I could put this one over?
Yeah.
But it wasn't quite the vibe that the crowd wanted. You know, it doesn't, even though it is, you know, it gets a little explicit. It's not an exploitation film per se.
I can see it definitely working better at AFS for sure. Like,
is there a lot of anthologies? I mean, is that the only one in the book? Like, have you programmed a lot of anthologies for Weird Wednesday that you remember, Lars?
You know, there were a number of sort of sex film anthologies. I mean, not like Immoral Tales. Like, Borowczyk is a different level of filmmaking, but there were a number of interesting German, like Schoolgirl Report type movies that we played. They weren't just Schoolgirl Report. Like, there was one called Swinging Coeds that is an anthology. That one was dubbed apparently in Atlanta, so everybody kind of has like Southern accents, but they're clearly in Munich, you know? That was kind of interesting. And it's also like there's like Southern rock playing on the soundtrack when people are dancing in discotheques and stuff. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, there were a lot of those sort of German report type movies that are anthologies that played. But yeah, it's hard to think of many other sort of anthology films that really played. I love anthology movies, though. I love the Amicus movies and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but sometimes the dubbing, that's what makes movies so much fun to watch. I did recently watch, it's not one of my picks, but Mr. Scarface.
Oh, my God.
And that's the English dub. Yeah,
the English dub. The dub version.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
So good. The dubbing is so good.
Yes, so funny. So it's perfect. They call each other turds and stuff all the time. You turd.
I like when our hero, played by Harry Bear, that was Fassbender's boyfriend, by the way, the kid in that. There's a lot of Fassbender crossover with DeLeo's movies for some reason. But like when he's trying to go exact, when he's trying to get the big bald guy to pay him, and he has like the whip and he's spinning him around, and the big bald guy says, "Fuck out of here." I think I've said that at times, you know, I just integrated that phrase into my head. Fuck out of here. It's like, who says that?
Yeah, I think there's another one that the kid said. He's like, fuck all of them and fuck you too.
Oh, my God. I love that. Yeah, he's on the walkie talkie.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so much like exaggerated grunting in the fights too. That just.
And Vittorio Caprioli, who plays Napoli in that, is so fucking funny.
Yeah.
That movie is great, but do not watch the subtitle version. I mean, the subtitle version, I'm sure, is fine. The dubbing is what really makes that movie go, though.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
Nice.
Oh, and let me recommend, since we're talking about Borowczyk, and you just watched The Beast, you said, Erica, right?
I did, yes.
Do you know about The Beast in Space?
Yes.
Okay, have you seen that one?
I have it on my shelf. I haven't watched it yet, though.
Wow.
I've heard, so I'm excited.
Yeah. You will see a lot of the same footage, like dreadfully cropped and in the wrong aspect ratio from La Bette in The Beast in Space. That is such an unbelievable movie. It's just incredible that it exists.
Can't wait. All right. Lance, what's your next pick?
Okay. I'm going to dive into a Matt Simber pick. He's the director who did The Witch Who Came from the Sea and Lady Coco. This is the Candy Tangerine Man from 1975.
Oh my God, that would have been so fun.
Yeah. So yeah, I would, again, this is going back to what we, you know, what I had mentioned. Watching this movie, I just kept thinking, man, this would be such a blast to watch in a theater with an audience. So it seems like a perfect fit for Weird Wednesday programming, Lars. I'm wondering how this one, you know, went with an audience. And
yeah, that played great. I mean, sometimes people will show up and they'll hear it's a blaxploitation film and maybe they haven't seen many blaxploitation movies, or maybe they seem like Shaft, which isn't really a blaxploitation movie, you know?
Right.
And they're not sure what to expect, but that really delivers everything. It's really sort of like the blaxploitation movie, I think, just in terms of like what it brings. Mm-hmm. It's everything that you want to see, like style wise and everything in a blaxploitation movie. I mean, I think Truck Turner is the best blaxploitation movie. Frankly, Candy Tangerine Man isn't probably even in my top 10 blaxploitation movies, but It really sort of delivers on the sort of style level in terms of the way that it looks, the way that it feels, the music, the performances, the sort of conflict in it. It all sort of works in a great way as kind of an exemplar of the blaxploitation film.
Yeah. Just watching it by myself, I mean, I find myself laughing out loud and I just have a huge smile on my face the whole time. Because the characters, I mean, if for the listeners, like you starting with Black Baron, who's played by actor John Daniels. So Daniels plays Ron Lewis, who is a successful LA businessman by day and a loving father with wife and kids. He has a nice suburban neighborhood. You even pointed out in a blurb in the book, Lars, he even mows his lawn.
Yeah.
But by night, he's the Black Baron, a powerful pimp. He's the king of all pimps. So we kind of watch him switch personas, kind of Jekyll and Hyde sort of thing, and wonder along the way if these different worlds will collide. Yeah, I mean, there's this one scene, I pointed it out in our Junesploitation episode, but there's this one scene where the Baron first goes home and we're introduced to his beautiful wife and his children in his, you know, suburban house. That reminds me of that first episode of Mad Men where Don Draper, you know, comes home to his family after a full day of just kind of sleeping with women and drinking hard. So it's this unexpected element that just quickly pulls you in and shows you how fascinating of a character the Black Baron is. And, you know, this is 1975. It predates Mad Men, obviously. So, and I do have to point out, it does have George Buck Flower in it playing one of the scumbag cops. Mm-hmm. He's clean cut. So it's definitely,
it's hard to recognize him as clean cut.
But yeah, again, like it's just a joy to watch. And this is one I own as well. It's a double feature disc from Vinegar Syndrome with Lady Coco, which is also directed by Matt Simber. Great movie.
Yeah, I like Candy Tangerine Man. I don't know if I love Daniels in the role exactly, you know?
He's a little muted, yeah. I mean, he's...
works, but like the movie could really be like a great one. It would be on my top 10 list, I think, if there were an actor. Like when you think of the great sort of blaxploitation performances like Robert Hooks and Trouble Man. Like that's one of the great performances. There's like a lot of nuance. There's a lot going on in that film.
Yeah.
It's not a super nuanced performance. He doesn't have a lot of charisma, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, he only had a few other credits to his name, right? What's the other one that I'm thinking of that he...
Can't remember? No.
I can't remember.
All right. We'll come back to you. Let me jump into my next pick. And this is one where I think it's unique for a lot of reasons, but mostly because a lot of movies will save a shock for the climax of the film or the very, very ending of the film. I think a lot of the shock in this film is in actually the first hour, and then it turns. It's a revenge film, and it's a very, very uncomfortable film. And a lot of the reason, like I said, I made my picks because these were ones that I would want to see with an audience. Yours are more like the fun ones. Mine are the ones where I'm like, I want to see how fucking uncomfortable everyone gets with the movie, this movie. And this is definitely one of them. It's Fight for Your Life, 1977.
We are a nation racked with violent crime. You are about to see a small sample of an extraordinary gut-crunching film that vividly portrays the most sadistic of these criminals.
And if we come in, they'll Chester King, ma'am, and I'll ask the questions. You understand? I'm going to teach these people a lesson they won't forget. Come on up, woman.
Hey, I'm going to cut her down. You're going to shoot through it now. Shut up!
Mother, turn, mother, turn.
Oh, God, me!
A story filled with unbelievable action, a movie of excruciating violence, a saga of extraordinary courage that will leave you cheering. Fight for your life.
Directed by Robert A. Anderson. Stars William Sanderson as Jesse Lee Kane, who's probably the most despicable villain ever put to screen. So Kane and two other escaped convicts kidnap the daughter of a preacher and bring her back to her family home, where the convicts are hiding from the police. And they torment the whole family. And torment is probably the most understated word I could possibly use to describe what they do to this family. It is filled with every racial epithet you can possibly imagine. It is really, really uncomfortable to watch for the first hour, but then like the tables finally get turned on them. Lars, how did Fight for Your Life play?
Well, I showed it a number of times, and it was always, I mean, you would be able to expect that it would get a really visceral reaction. I mean, imagine how it played on 42nd Street, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, let alone like with decades to go and with like the whole sort of irony revolution that had happened that affected the way that we process, you know, inputs. Like, we've gone through a lot that has given us some sort of cushioning for a movie like Fight for Your Life to sort of like be processed. We have the tools to process Fight for Your Life now. Mm-hmm. Imagine on 42nd Street in 1980 or whenever, you know, it's like the everybody must have been so perturbed and upset. It's a movie that I think it could almost kind of skate by and not be considered an irresponsible movie. The director doesn't do a great job, you know, like most of the actors don't do a great job. Frankly, it's not a very well-made film. But then William Sanderson is so good in the role, and he brings so much commitment to this that he pours gasoline onto the damn movie, you know, just because he really brings his A game to this part that is so despicable and so hateful that it sort of throws the whole thing out of balance because the other performers aren't really very good, you know. The counterbalance, like the good guy dad, is not especially memorable. Mm-hmm. But Sanderson is so absolutely terrific in the role that he really pushes it over into a kind of, it makes it a really sort of hateful movie, actually.
Yeah. He is the absolute standout and the main reason for watching this. And I agree, it's not a very well-made film. I think even the ratio of the torture to vengeance is pretty out of whack. Like, you know, you as a viewer, you want to see like, okay, these people went through something so reprehensible. And yes, the villains get it in the end, but almost like not enough, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, it's true.
So
there couldn't be enough. You'd have to have like an atom bomb, you know, to blow them up to be enough.
Yeah.
Because it's so bad.
It really is.
Like, it's so true. Like, I do wish that it had been a better directed film and that there was a more dynamic performance on the part of the adversary, which is the black dad in this. I just wish there were more to it because, I mean, Sanderson is giving it everything, but he's honestly kind of maybe giving it too much.
Yeah, but I'm thankful for how much he gave because it does at least makes it worth it. And it's so, I mean, every time he opens his mouth, you're just like, oh God, what's he going to say next? It's so uncomfortable. So
he calls that old woman Deputy Dog. Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
Come here, Deputy Dog. And you're looking at her and you're like, yeah, she kind of does look like Deputy Dog. That's so cool. You know, that's not in the script either.
Oh, wow.
he's just going with, I mean, I don't know if it's in the script. I'd be surprised.
Right. I doubt it.
It just sounds like an ad lib, you know? Yeah,
for sure. It absolutely does. All right, Lance, I'm sure you have a much happier movie than what I just
did. No,
probably not. That's what mean.
Okay, so I'm sticking with this. I'm staying on the same page as the Candy Tangerine Man, and I'm going with the Candy Snatchers from 1973, directed by Gurdon Trueblood.
It started as a simple crime, the Candy Snatchers. For them, it was a new beginning. For her, it was the beginning of the end. Three losers who wanted to lead the good life. The Candy Snatchers. They'd do anything to get there.
Drat! Oh, please don't put me back in the hole!
The Candy Snatchers. They were rough on candy. They were rougher on themselves.
To quote Lars in this book, this is a mean-spirited black comedy that neatly encapsulates everything that was great and scary and wrong and right about the 70s, which to me, it's all about the dark humor. I think it's out of this world. One of my favorite new-to-me movies of this past year was Larry Cohen's Bone with Yaphet Kotto, which that was one of my top new-to-me's. And I found that the dark comedy in The Candy Snatchers gave off some of the same vibes. Obviously, it goes way darker in some with some of the content, but I feel like it was made for me. I mean, the dark humor is so well done, and what an ending. I mean, that. So for those who haven't watched it, I mean, it's about a young teenage girl named Candy, who is the daughter of a diamond shop manager, and she's kidnapped by these three kind of amateur criminals, two tough guys and an even tougher woman, who demand a ransom from her father. But the problem is that the father doesn't seem interested with paying it at all and paying into their demands, or even interested in getting his daughter back. The idea of having no child seems pretty, pretty luxurious. There are reasons behind it. So we kind of witness how they change up their plans in order to get paid for the kidnapped Candy. And while this is happening, there's this mute autistic boy who's actually played by the director's real life son. He's a goofy little guy, but he witnesses where Candy's being held, and he's kind of involved behind the scenes during this whole movie. So it all unravels for everyone involved with tons of plot twists, a lot of jaw dropping moments. Like you wrote, Lars, there's just some mean spirited and some wrong scenes involving, you know, abuse and rape. But it's kind of necessary to show how cruel these three people are and are willing to go to get paid. I just love it. And I would think it would have done well with especially a Weird Wednesday audience.
Yeah, it works. It worked really well, of course, as you can detect. I mean, it's a really well-made film. Mm-hmm. And while like with Fight for Your Life, I think that's almost kind of a reprehensible film. I don't feel that way about Candy Snatchers. I think Candy Snatchers is operating from a real place of conscious sort of irony and using like it's like a Buñuel film. In a way, like it is an art film in its own way, mm-hmm. In terms of what it's saying, like the father, the Ben Piazza father of Candy is a reprehensible person, but there's things that are being sort of said about American society in this film 100%. that are sort of deep. And in fact, the sort of kidnappers are not the most reprehensible people in this, in a way, like we kind of see them kind of transmuted to being maybe among the most likable people in the film, weirdly. Yeah, it's a really special movie. That's one that's like, you talked about Arthur Marx earlier. That's one that's sort of, it's credited as presented by Arthur Marx. I don't even know what the hell that means.
I didn't either.
It does make me wonder, like, if Arthur Marx had a hand in the screenplay or something, you know? It's a fine film. It's a really good movie that could be screened. It's a good example of a bad movie that is a bad movie, not in the sense that it is poorly made. It's a bad movie in the sense of like wearing leather jackets and smoking cigarettes. It's like that kind of bad movie. It's bad because it's sort of socially unacceptable because of what it's saying, you know?
Right.
All right. My next one is one that it has a very distinctive flavor, and that's of kind of
like all your picks.
All of them. Yeah. Just sort of goes from like one scene to another and not much happens, but then the ending is one that you're just like, oh, okay. So It is a Joe D'Amato film, Black Cobra, 1976, starring the gorgeous Laura Gemser, as well as Jack Palance. Lance, who you can do an impression of. You don't have to. But.
I won't. I did one last episode.
Okay, not two in a row? Fair enough.
I'm on number one.
All right, so Black Cobra. There, we've got two brothers, Judas and Jules. One of them is Jack Palance. I forget which one. I think it's Judas. They invite Eva, who's Laura Gemser's character. She is an exotic snake dancer, to come live with them in Hong Kong. And both of them become transfixed on her. Most of the plot is, you know, Jack Palance showing off his snake collection. I mean, literal snakes. Sorry, folks. And then Laura Gemser and her female friend being intimate. But then the other brother, Jules, he finds a way to kill her partner, the woman that she's been sleeping with, by using one of his brother Judas's snakes. And so Eva gets revenge on one of the brothers. And that's like the ending of it's not the very end. Like, you're not left with it, which I kind of wish it was, actually. But I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. I'm going to leave it alone and just let you experience how she gets revenge. If you do watch Black Cobra by Joe D'Amato, if you've seen a Joe D'Amato film, it shouldn't be surprising to you.
Even then it's surprising. Even if you've watched other Joe D'Amato movies, it is so, it goes there in such a way. Wow. It's incredible.
Yeah. I could just look at Laura Gemser just all day. Like, she is gorgeous in all of the Emmanuel films that she's in. I'm just like, even if I'm just not super into the movie, it's at least I have her to look at. Cause she is just, she's a goddess. Like, I'm really looking forward to, Severin's putting out Caligula, The Untold Story, next month or February, I think. Yeah. And, oh God, I cannot wait to have that on my shelf.
and Laura Gemser, particularly, yes, Laura Gemser, of course, yes. But Laura Gemser photographed by Joe D'Amato, like, specifically, as to get to a level of detail that nobody really needs. Like, yes, Laura Gemser in Bido Albertini's first Black Emmanuel movie is gorgeous and beautiful. But Joe D'Amato really had a way of, he understood Laura Gemser as a photographic subject. And so he made so many of those Emmanuel movies, and this is effectively almost an Emmanuel movie, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the way Joe D'Amato photographs her, I love Black Cobra. For me is among my favorite cinematic experiences. I mean, it really is. And that's hard. It's probably hard to sort of put across. It's like, why would that be? Because, like, if you break down the plot, you know, what's the story saying? It's like, it's not much, but it really is Laura Gemser being photographed in these locations in under this light, the nightclub act where she's dancing with the snake, all of these things put together with Piero Umiliani's score, which is kind of cobbled together from a lot of different cues from Umiliani. It all just sort of works. It's transcendent to me. There's something sort of transcendently beautiful and erotic, and it really gets to the heart of what I want in film and what I want in things to look at and to listen to in the world. It's one of my favorite films, and I have to congratulate you on just the films that you've chosen. I mean, you've got such good taste. You both have such good taste. But to choose this one as among those is like, really, I really think that you guys get it. But yeah, that's a real special one to me. If I were going to choose among all of these films, one that I absolutely had to rescue for a desert island or something, it might actually even be Black Cobra, just because I love it that much.
Yeah. I made some notes about it. I was like, I can't describe the plot and I didn't want it to come across like, oh, nothing happens in this movie, because I'm never bored watching this movie. Because
Laura Gemser happens in this movie. What happens in this movie is everything else is sort of a dual setting, and then Laura Gemser is what happens in this movie.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are not going to get that, you know, but it's true. Laura Gemser is what happens in this movie.
That's it. That's the plot. All right, Lance, last pick.
this would probably not be on a desert island pick for you, Lars, but we'll see. I'm not entirely proud of this pick. I wanted to lean into the warped aspect of the book title and pick something that would likely, you know, likely takes people out of their comfort zone. But I feel like it's a solid representation of warped, and I'm going with the very unpleasant, filthy Danish sexploitation horror film, The Sinful Dwarf from 1973. Yeah, directed by Vidal Raski. Just to summarize, I mean, the title in and of itself, The Sinful Dwarf, I mean, it's very intriguing. But most of the summaries that I found out there, they kind of focus on that title character, Olaf, the Sinful Dwarf. But it's really his mother who has, I think, one of the catchiest names in film, Lila Lash, which is just a great name. But she's running this gross operation of luring young women into her boarding house. Olaf sometimes uses wind-up toys as bait, and then turns them into these sex slaves, shooting them full of heroin, which they buy from a drug dealer named Santa Claus. And the men come to the attic where these women are chained and kept, and then they pay for sex with these kidnapped women. So it's quite terrible. It's not necessarily enjoyable, but you can't look away. Each sex scene goes on too long and are as awkward as you'd imagine. But for me, it's about Olaf's mother, Lila Lash, and watching her antics. Usually when she has company over, well, first off, she has this mysterious scar going across her face, which I don't think they explain at all in the film. It's a fake, you know, makeup scar. But in the movie, she sees herself as a performer. So, you know, the raunchy sex scenes are kind of periodically broken up by musical numbers of her singing in character. And her performances are so captivating because it's hard for her to hold a note due to all the beefeater London dry gin she's downing in every scene. So you're just watching her get through these numbers while hoping she and Olaf get what they deserve in the end, which I won't spoil, but definitely not for everyone or anyone really. I mean, it's enjoyable. It's worth the experience in my eyes and ears, you know, listening to Lila Lash sing. But yeah, how did the Sinful Dwarf, what's the reaction to that character and how, you know, some people are represented in that film, Lars?
This is a good example of one that I kind of got my arm twisted into showing. And I think it might've been like Aunt Timpson and Tim were kind of like, I had seen The Sinful Dwarf and I didn't like it very much. I just couldn't see it working with an audience kind of, but they were like, oh, you got to show The Sinful Dwarf, right? When are you going to show The Sinful Dwarf? You still got that kind of Sinful Dwarf. When are you going to show it?
And eventually, I think the idea sounds better than actually watching it.
Exactly. I kind of caved and showed it because, like, I don't know. I didn't think it would work with an audience very well, but I mean, of course I knew that with a title like Sinful Dwarf, it would draw. There's just kind of a balance that goes on when you're programming a weekly series. It's like, I knew that everybody and his brother would show up for The Sinful Dwarf and then they would have a fucking bad time. So and that's what happened. Everybody showed up for The Sinful Dwarf and they had a fucking bad time. So I don't know. It's such a tightrope walk, you know, like, yes, it's wonderful to draw a bunch of people, but then when like everybody has a bad time, then like some of the same people don't show up the next week. And that sucks. Like you like actually like lose a friend sometimes because
this should have been pulled from the book. Yeah, that's I had a friend who did go. He did see it at Weird Wednesday, and he was like, "Yeah, from what I remember, because I was talking to him about it when I watched it fairly recently. So from what I remember of it, it's just slow. Nothing really happens, and it's kind of forgettable, but
it's sort of dark. It's dark and unpleasant, like life.
It's very unpleasant.
What people want.
Lance is looking at me. He's like, that's what Erica wants.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I don't feel good about that pick. I'm not proud of that pick, but I picked it.
And all right.
It's a good discussion to have.
You know, I haven't watched it since the bad vibe screening of it. There's nothing like, it's bad enough when you show like the molesters for like 40 people, you know, but showing Sinful Dwarf for 200 people and they're just like, they show up, they're all wound up and ready to go. And then you just hear their enthusiasm just drop off and drop off and drop off. And then, you know, some people get up and leave. It's so depressing to like have a movie just kind of not work.
And yeah. You only showed it one time?
I think I only showed it one time.
Okay.
And there was like people would request it and everything, but I just sometimes you just know a movie is just kind of a bad vibe movie and it doesn't work, and yeah. you just it's just not what you want to put out there. It's a thing that I kind of go through with like Jasmine Moreno, who programs the Lates, and she's like the most talented programmer I think I know in the world. And so, but she's still kind of like getting into that place where she's been programming the series for a few years and trying to figure out like how to not alienate the audience who are like a habit audience coming week after week, mm-hmm. but at the same time, still kind of showing adventurous stuff. Mm-hmm. And yeah. it's a real sort of challenge. I'm kind of reliving it as I see her kind of go through that process of making Lates work and playing things that are sort of adventurous or things that are sort of special favorites. But at the same time, being cognizant of the fact that you want to not alienate your audience entirely, that there is a habit aspect to a weekly series that you have to be aware of, that people are kind of sometimes coming every week or they're bringing friends. Right. And if they have a bad vibe experience, if they just have like a bad experience and they don't enjoy the film or they don't get anything out of the film, then you might just lose them forever.
Yeah. I mean, I would think regulars would know like, hey, whoa, this is like, you know, I've been going to Terror Tuesdays pretty much nonstop since like 2013. And there are some bad apples that are kind of thrown in, but at the same time, it's kind of good to kind of throw and keep people on their toes and guessing like, whoa, I wasn't expecting a movie like The Sinful Dwarf to creep in.
And I've seen sort of Joe's journey through weekly series too, because when you started watching it, Zach was gone by that time probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Joe was hosting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you've seen Joe kind of go through his sort of... I'm fascinated by watching people who do weekly series and seeing how they program, because Joe had a period where he went through, he was showing things like Scream and stuff like that, you know, to try to like really go out, really charge hard after an audience and like get a crowd in and make the series profitable and stuff like that. And I've seen him kind of change his sort of trajectory of the journey that he's taking with Terror Tuesday to kind of make it more of like, hey, come out or don't. You know, like this really is sort of like, I'm giving you my best. I'm not giving you like the Scream stuff anymore. I'm giving you my best. And if you don't like it, then that's fine. Somebody will take the seat who will like it. And eventually we'll have the audience that's like really perfectly supportive for this.
Right. Because I think in your book, too, you had mentioned it's not necessarily about the films. It's about the experience and the whole community and the idea and selling all this kind of ballyhoo, you know, and just kind of bringing people in, which is kind of what these programs, Weird Wednesday, Terror Tuesday, is all about. It's just experiencing it with your group of friends. It's not about the film necessarily.
Yeah, I'd like to program the audience, sort of. You know what I mean? I'd like to feel like that this is the stuff that gets the kind of people together that I want to kind of hang out with, and that hopefully they want to hang out with. I mean, yes, I'm interested in the films, obviously.
Right.
It's sort of an oversimplification to say that we're programming the audience. But at the same time, it really is sort of like, these are the movies that I like, but I'm not showing everything just because I like it. And I certainly have some depraved tastes that I would not try to force on a crowd because I don't think it would quite work. So It's not just a matter of like, this is the stuff, this is the shit I'm into, man. Just deal with it.
Right.
It
has to be sort of a sense of like, this is the stuff that I'm into, that other people will be into, and that, you know, can reach a wider band of people. There will be things like Black Cobra that I don't know if people quite get, but that I really feel God in that movie, you know? So I am going to play stuff like that sometimes, even if I don't understand why I like it, that I am feeling God in that movie. And I assume that others will get it too. And for some people, some people won't like it, but some people will have an ecstatic experience from it.
All right.
Erica, last pick.
Last pick. Before I do that, I did want to just kind of circling back to Jasmine and her programming for Lates. Like, I love the Lates series. And I mean, she has introduced me to so many things that would have been so far off my radar. And it's been so awesome to see what she is bringing to the table. She even, in our last episode, we did like a best of 2021 new to us. And one of the movies that she programmed, Jan Svankmajer's Faust was in my list. Cause that was like one of my favorite films that was new to me that I watched this year that she programmed. So Jasmine is great. I love the Late series.
Yeah, she's an awesome programmer, and I don't do Weird Wednesdays anymore. I wouldn't want to do Weird Wednesdays anymore, but I'm so glad that we have the Lates series, which is quite different from Weird Wednesday, obviously. It's just a different kind of feel.
Yeah.
But I can understand, as well as just about anybody, just what an incredible job she does with that series, having been a programmer of a weekly series myself for so many years.
Yeah, she's great. All right, last pick. Maybe I'm not proud of this one either, Lance. I'm going to say that. This is another one I'm very curious about audience reaction to it, because the first time I saw this was with a very large group of people. We were doing a marathon, and this movie divided the room. It was basically me and John on one side, like, yeah, this movie. I'm like, oh God, this movie is like, I can't believe it went there. And then the other half of the room was like, what the fuck about this movie? So Toys Are Not for Children, 1972 is my last pick.
Even in this age of permissiveness, Toys Are Not for Children will shock you. Make you wonder where good ends and bad begins. Whether or not there really is a difference between the two. Toys Are Not for Children, an experience you will not forget.
It is about Jamie, who's an emotionally stunted young woman who is fixated on the toys that she was given as a child by her father. She gets a job at a toy store and marries a coworker, but the marriage doesn't work out, mainly due to her fixation on her absent father. So she goes to New York and becomes a prostitute who specializes in servicing old men who want to play daddy with her. And this is another one where I am not going to give away the ending. You're either here for it or you're not. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Lars, how Toys Are Not for Children.
Oh, it's such a special feeling to watch that with an audience. Because, yeah, the film, it's like there are a film can have choices. Like there are choice characters can make choices in film, you know?
Yeah.
And as you watch them sort of make the choices, you sort of, we're all sort of like thinking ahead. But if we've watched more than, you know, a few hundred movies, we know how movies work. And so we're watching the sort of heroine's journey in this film, and doors open and she goes through the wrong one kind of every time. Mm-hmm. And to the point where there are just fewer and fewer ways that the movie can go. And we're anticipating the next step in the film. And we're like, well, clearly we know it can't go there. So what's going to happen? This trajectory of the heroine is not going to be exactly where we see it going as people who've watched a lot of movies. So what's going to happen? And then she just walks right into it. You know, they set the controls for the Heart of the Sun. You know what I mean? It's just like, there's no way out. I mean, I imagine this might be sort of spoily in a way, but it doesn't matter. Even if you haven't seen this movie, you're not going to believe where it goes. Because you've just been indoctrinated in watching so many movies. Even if you watch like a lot of porno movies or a lot of sexploitation movies, they just don't go there mostly.
Mostly, yeah.
I guess Taboo kind of does. But yeah, this is, it becomes this sort of inexorable ending that you can't accept, and that yet it happens anyway. And yeah, it's amazing with an audience. The crowd just begins to sort of get wound up. As we sort of approach the ending of the film, the crowd is in such, they're just sort of hot and bothered about it, sort of, I guess, is the way it sounds. I don't know if they're actually turned on. I think they're just sort of disgusted / they're certainly not turned on. I was saying that. Disgusted sort of / there for it. You know what I mean?
Right.
All at the same time. And it is a really, it's a crazy machine. It's a well-made film too, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really good performance. Like the guy who plays her husband is really good, I think. There's just a lot kind of going on in the film that I really like, and that it works along those lines. I don't think it's like a work of art or something, but I think it's a really well structured story.
This is the one out of my five that if I had to pick one where I could go back in time and be in a crowd watching this would be the one. And that's like the part of me that's like, I want to go through the roller coaster. I want to go through all the wrong doors with the audience in this one. Like you mentioned, it's an uncomfortable movie. It's, you know, I gave my disclaimer on all my picks. They're not for everyone beforehand, but this is the one that I was like, if I had to pick one, I would definitely want to see this in theater with the group. So
it is sort of fun though. It's not like kind of Fight for Your Life where there's a lot of discomfort or like Sinful Dwarf or something with so much discomfort. There's discomfort, but it's also kind of an electric discomfort kind of, it's sort of a fun discomfort.
Yeah. Agree.
Erica, I mentioned a Henry Silva movie earlier.
Yes.
And I looked it up at this point on Letterboxd, thankfully. Mm-hmm. It's called The Insolent, and it has different names too, but I don't remember the other title that I have it under. It's directed by Jean-Claude Roy, also known as Patrick Aubin, who made a bunch of interesting French sexploitation and porn films. But it is I think Jean-Claude Roy was a huge fan of some of the sort of nastier Italian ones, and he kind of set out to make the ultimate kind of Henry Silva being a nasty badass movie. And I really recommend The Insolent a lot.
Just added it to my watch list on Letterboxd. Yes. Thank you. So before we close out here, are there any particular movies from the book or standout experiences, theater experiences that you wanted to share from the book?
You know, one that it continually sort of comes to mind, and I don't know why, when I was asked back, like after I quit doing Weird Wednesday, I was kind of asked back to like guest and choose a title. It might have even been my birthday or something like that. I chose Massacre of Pleasure. And I don't know why I love that film so much. I love French movies. I love European movies generally. I love dubbed European movies. I love pulp movies. I love European movies that sort of take their inspiration from American pulp and all of that. Massacre of Pleasure feels very much like a Jean Roland film in the way that it sort of relates to sort of pulp literature in particular. It's one that I really like a lot. It's not one that has a great reputation. It's a print that I bought from a guy in Kansas City for, you know, $20 or something. And it became really one of my favorites. And it's, we talked a little bit about films that are impossible to sort of exactly describe why you like them, but they sort of really stick with you. Massacre of Pleasure for me is maybe the ultimate one of those films for me. I can't explain why I like it so much, but I absolutely love it. I have a receptor in my brain for Massacre of Pleasure.
That was, if we were doing 10 movies, that was on my short list. That and Ginger and Eugenie were also like, I had a list of 10 and I was like pared it down to 5, but that was in there. And
you've seen Massacre of Pleasure?
Yeah. I watched it after picking up the book. See people, this is why you pick up the book. You find movies you haven't seen before and get good recommendations for stuff like that. So,
I should note, I want to plug the book just in a tiny little way. Cause like, I think if I were hearing about this book, I'd be like, oh no, I get it. I know trauma movies, all this kind of bullshit. It's really not. Oh, it really is movies that are ripped from the earth. It's
like,
some of this is stuff that you've heard of. It's not all like the most obscure stuff in the world, but there is stuff in this that you have never heard of that I never would have heard of had I not gone to a drive-in in rural Texas and saw it sitting over in the corner and offered to pay the guy who owned the drive-in $15 for the print. You know, like there are some incredibly obscure films here.
So one that I wanted to bring up before we close out here, because I know it is, and it's mentioned a few times in the book as being the ultimate Weird Wednesday movie. And it was one that you had screened at Fantastic Fest as well. And that's Snakes.
It's so good.
And
I was at your last showing of that, your last Weird Wednesday of that, where, you know, Tim came out with the marching band. And if I remember correctly, the marching band came out at the end as well. And we kind of did a conga line over to Mugshots where Tim was buying rounds of drinks, if I remember.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Well, we all went to Mugshots. I know that. I don't know how we got there, but I don't know if you were there, honestly, but I know.
I was there, but I don't remember much of it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
I remember that was people continually handing me drinks.
I was probably one of them, so sorry about that.
But that movie is so special. It felt like a Weird Wednesday experience, because every time he goes to dump another body, the audience is just losing their mind, and it's so much fun to watch with a crowd. And that was such a great experience, and I'm so glad I got to see that in theater at Fantastic Fest with a group of with a crowded theater. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's tough to beat that movie. It's like, yeah, and it's exactly that. It's when it goes into sort of repetitive movements with the cars that the crowd is just so on. They're so on Snaky Bender's side. They're so on the side of this movie.
Yeah,
it's kind of a weirdly perfect movie. It really is.
So much fun. So that and plenty of other near perfect, questionable, off the wall, art house, exploitation, sex films, all the good stuff is in this book. We'll have a link to where you can buy it in show notes. We'll have links to where you can follow Lars on AFS Viewfinders and as well as on Letterboxd and Twitter and Instagram. And then if you are not already, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at Hex Massacre.
You can follow me, Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at L Scheibe.
Next week, we are kicking off Giallo January with Red Rings of Fear. We got Death by Dildo and Fabio Testi and Jack Taylor on a roller coaster, folks. So,
yes.
Should be a lot of fun. And Lars, thank you so much once again for joining us and sharing all your insights about these films. And just thank you for the book in general. Yeah. It's great.
Well, thank Kayla Janice and Luke Insect, who laid the damn thing out, all the work on the film, on the book, that is. And thank you. You guys have amazing tastes. I've talked to a lot of different people, some of whom are just kind of have a glancing idea of what all this stuff is. You guys get it. You're on it. I'm going to become a listener of your podcast, and I really appreciate all of your insights.
Oh, thanks, awesome. Lars.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. All right. So thanks again to everyone for listening, and we'll see you back next week for Giallo January. Night, y'all.
Bye.
Listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.